Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Family, friends, and fans are mourning the loss of designer Kate Spade and TV host and chef Anthony Bourdain. Both took their lives last week. These deaths are a difficult reminder of a growing problem. Americans are ending their lives at increasing rates. According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, over the last two decades, suicide rates across the country have increased by nearly 30%. Nearly 45,000 suicides occurred in the United States in 2016. Guns accounted for 51% of all suicides that year. North Dakota saw the sharpest increase, with suicides rising more than 57% since 1999. Unlike Anthony Bourdain and Kate Spade, more than half of the people captured in the study had no known mental illness. The CDC says a variety of circumstances were observed in those who ended their lives, including life stressors and recent and impending crises. So what do we know about what puts someone at risk for suicide? And how can we focus more on suicide prevention and ensure that people actually get the help that they need? Today, we are joined by Cecilia Villalobos, Development Coordinator with San Francisco Suicide Prevention, the oldest community-based telephone crisis center in the country. Cecilia has been a volunteer with the Suicide Hotline for 2 years, and she joins us in studio. Hi, Cecilia. Thank you for coming
in. Hi, Rose. Thank you for inviting us.
We're also joined by David Elliott Lewis, a mental health advocate and vice president of the Board of Directors of the Mental Health Association of San Francisco. That's an organization that fights stigma and discrimination in mental health across diverse communities. David also serves on the board of the National Alliance of Mental Illness and is a trainer for the San Francisco Police Department's Crisis Intervention Training Program. And David also joins us in studio. Thank you for coming in, David.
I'm happy to be here.
Well, we also want to let you know that if you're struggling with suicidal thoughts, you can call this number from anywhere in the United States 24 hours a day. It's 800-273-8255, 800-273-8255. There's also online chat available if you don't want to actually talk to anyone over the phone. Cecilia, let's start off with you. The suicides of Kate Spade and Anthony Bourdain have really sparked a much-needed conversation about suicide, about prevention, about resources. What are your overall thoughts about the conversations you've been hearing?
Yeah, so people have been very vocal about their opinions and their beliefs and their stories on Twitter and other social media platforms. And I think, coupled with the CDC report that came out last week, people are realizing that suicide prevention is a much larger initiative involving, you know, the government, federal and state government, public health officials, and not just, you know, mental health nonprofits or mental health sectors. People are acknowledging that it's a much more complex issue and it can affect anyone. You know, suicide and suicidal ideation doesn't discriminate. Yeah, so I think I'm glad that the conversation is reaching a much broader audience, and we have a more holistic understanding, or we're trying to develop a more holistic understanding of suicide and suicide prevention now.
Mm. David, what about you?
The two most recent celebrity suicides by hanging drew a lot of attention. They're not representative of what's actually been happening for most people. Most recent suicides are young white men, and they use firearms. And the conversation about easy access to firearms, especially for people under 21, isn't really being discussed. Mm. It's not part of our national conversation. Another thing that's not being discussed is the role of stigma that prevents people from even seeking help. And I'll talk further in this program about what we can do to reduce that barrier. Sometimes it's a gossamer thin barrier that prevent people from actually getting the help they need. And it's often fear of what other people think, fear of self-stigma, fear of what they'll think of themselves if they admit they need help from a mental health professional. And those are big issues that aren't getting talked about enough.
Hmm. Well, we'll talk about those issues in a minute. Do you have any criticism of the coverage and the conversations you've been hearing around this? Cecilia?
I'm not sure if I have criticism per se. I think all conversations are good conversations, especially when they plug people to resources like crisis lines or local in-person resources. Yeah, like I mentioned before, I'm really glad that the conversation is opening up to different factors that affect a person's decision to die by suicide.
The one thing I've been hearing is people are saying the media should not say committed suicide.
But died by suicide?
Or took their own life?
I think the language has changed. They're trying again, and that's an attempt to fight stigma and to not demonize the person. In the past, suicide was considered a criminal act, and it was a murder against yourself, a self-murder, and you were actually committing a major felony. I think we've gotten away from criminalizing suicide and criminalizing mental illness. We still have a long ways to go, but I think the shift in language is part of that.
And do you think there's been enough focus specifically on prevention, and what should that conversation sound like?
I believe, this is David, that there has not been enough focus on prevention, and especially in making it easy to get help and to know where the help is. Just a small example. San Francisco has an excellent behavioral health service. We have a number of free behavioral health clinics that people can walk into to get help. But if you walked right by one, including one on Mission Street, you wouldn't even know it's there because they don't put signs on any of them on the front. So unless you looked it up online, you'd never know that you live next to or work next to a mental health clinic that could actually help you when you're in a time of crisis. And I think that's just that the city's unwillingness to put a sign on their own clinics is just one example of the stigma we place around seeking help when you're depressed, when you're suicidal. We need to change that conversation. We need to change that attitude.
Well, let's talk more about getting help and resources, because in this country, a lot of people struggle to find resources because of our healthcare system. And Kristen Powers wrote in USA Today that her own psychiatrist did not take her seriously when she said she was thinking about ending her life because she didn't present herself as disheveled and listless like someone, a suicidal person, I guess, is expected to appear. And then Jennifer Posner, who's a media critic in New York, just wrote a piece for the Village Voice called "Who Are We Telling Depressed People to Reach Out to Anyway?" Judging someone for not getting help is not just rude, but dangerous. And she talked about how, as a freelance writer, when she was younger, she had a hard time making ends meet. And she did reach out for help and asked a therapist for a sliding scale fee. And it was $75 to $100 an hour, something she could not afford. And when she told the therapist, "I can't afford that," the therapist was offended. So how do we deal with that? Cecilia?
Yeah. I think I've heard a lot of similar stories, especially from people of color, young people of color who may not have financial resources like other groups of people do. There is a lot of like defensiveness when it comes to reaching out to healthcare professionals or mental health care professionals because, sometimes the healthcare field isn't equipped to help people who don't have resources already. And it's really a lack of compassion, I think, a lack of empathy, a lack of understanding, and a lack of willingness to, you know, work with someone who really needs help. Unfortunately, I think it's focused a lot on people who, you know, can afford to have these resources.
Right. And I notice even for a simple doctor's appointment, it's the insurance card is the first thing that they ask about, not even how are you. Where's your insurance card? And if you don't have good insurance or if you're in a bad state, that's something that's very difficult to deal with.
If you do live in San Francisco, though, there are a few resources, a hotline and a warm line, a hotline run by Suicide Prevention, a warm line run by the Mental Health Association, which is staffed by will be volunteers, currently paid staff, that people with their own lived experience. It's not just counselors who are willing to talk to you, but counselors who've actually had their own lived experience with mental illness. And I think that's important. The city of San Francisco does have free mental health services for people who can't afford it. Where the rub comes in is for people who do have income but may not have enough adequate health insurance to cover their behavioral health needs but don't quite qualify for free services either. And I think that's who you're talking about, that woman who couldn't afford the $75 minimum fee, but maybe she might not have qualified for free services because she wasn't in total poverty either. So she fell between the cracks. So the system is broken.
Right. And what does it look like in other parts of the country? Because we also err in other states.
Yeah. So I just read this morning that I was reading about Latina teenagers attempting suicide at a ridiculously high rate. And the higher rates are found in states where, like, Latinx people are at a lower population. So, you know, Midwestern states. Yeah, I think in some states or in some locations, there might be a bigger barrier in between people who need help and the help that is offered. I think it, usually across the board, healthcare caters to a very specific population. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it can be even worse in other parts of the country.
Fortunately, the Affordable Care Act, which is still in effect while it's being slowly dismantled by our federal government, does have a parity requirement that requires that all health insurance coverage provide behavioral health care, at least some behavioral health care. That may go away soon because the federal administration has promised to not defend it in court. So as it's basically pulled apart piece by piece, we may lose that mental health parity. But that parity had been missing for many years. Where you had health insurance that didn't quite cover mental health needs, just physical health needs. Now we have both, but it's still inadequate, and it looks like we're about to lose that too.
Mm.
I see us moving backwards.
Well, what would you say to people who might live in an area that is under-resourced? What should they do? What's available for them, Cecilia?
Well, right off the top of my head, the National Lifeline, if they're thinking about suicide or if they're worried about someone who might be thinking about suicide. I mean, it's toll-free and it's accessible 24/7. That is a free resource. Local crisis lines are usually toll-free as well and accessible.
And this is 800-273-8255, and there's also chat available.
Yeah. I also want to recommend that people be willing to share this with their own primary care physician. Mm-hmm. Most people don't have psychiatrists, but most people do have primary care physicians. And I also put a call out for more training of primary care physicians on the issue of suicide and mental illness. I think they're inadequately trained, but still, it's a point of contact into the medical system where they can possibly get help. If you have a cold, how do you know? How can you self-diagnose whether it's something really serious like pneumonia or just a mild cold that goes away? Only a doctor can tell. And in some ways, doctors are in a better position to assess, maybe prescribe better treatment or make a referral that can get you the help you need. But it won't happen if you don't ask for help. So anything you can do to encourage a friend or loved one to reach out to their doctor and share with that doctor their current thinking about harming themselves, I think is the right step.
David Elliott Lewis is a mental health advocate and vice president of the Board of Directors of the Mental Health Association of San Francisco. That organization fights stigma and discrimination in mental health across diverse communities. Today, we are also joined by Cecilia Villalobos, development coordinator with San Francisco Suicide Prevention, the oldest community-based telephone crisis center in the country. Cecilia has been a volunteer with its suicide hotline for 2 years. And we are having a much-needed conversation in this country about suicide and suicide prevention and also resources because of the recent suicides of designer Kate Spade and TV host and chef Anthony Bourdain. What are your thoughts on the conversations that you've been hearing, the articles that you have been reading? What do you think those conversations do well? What do you think is missing from those conversations? If you or someone you know has been personally affected by suicide, what kind of support was available and what helped you. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. If you have a general question for our guests, you can also email yourcall@kalw.org. You can also go to KALW's Facebook page, click on the video there, and then join the conversation. Cecilia, you have been a volunteer with the Suicide Hotline at San Francisco Suicide Prevention for 2 years. Can you talk about that experience? What do you say to people to make them feel supported, and what kinds of resources do you share with them?
Yeah, so I think most people who call in with suicidal ideation feel really alone. It's a loneliness issue, as well as, you know, maybe some depression and life stressors. But I think we really emphasize not finding the silver lining in the situation, and not saying things like, oh, it's going to get better, like, you'll be okay, you know, cliches like that. I think what we do is really about getting down on their level and being like, hey, I see you, you're in pain. You know, you didn't deserve these things that happened to you. Life is really hard for you right now. I hear that. I know that. And, you know, truly empathizing rather than sympathizing. Mm. And I think that way, being able to empathize with them helps them feel less alone.
I would add to that, I mean, meeting people where they're at, and not saying anything that leaves the person feeling judged or condemned,
right,
or being in the wrong for even wanting to think about self-harming.
Right.
But
yeah,
anything we can do to make it easier for that person, even if it means going with them to get help, not just giving them a number to call necessarily or an address to go, but actually going with them, with our friend, to take them to get help, to make it just as easy as possible to lower that barrier to getting help. Because while it seems simple to us to say, oh, here's a number to call, mm-hmm, or a place to visit, to the person in pain, that might be an insurmountable mental barrier,
right,
between getting where they are and walking through that door to that clinic. And walking with them, with your friend or loved one, to that clinic can make all the difference in the world.
Yeah, definitely. If you have a friend or loved one who you're trying to help, that would be great. Unfortunately, we can't do that with our callers for legal reasons. But we try to be their friend as much as possible. And, you know, if they're open to therapy or finding resources, even if they're free resources in San Francisco, we do have, you know, a list of referrals if people are interested.
I think what you said about empathy is very important, because after these suicides happened on social media, people said, hey, everybody, check in on your friends, check in on your family, mm-hmm, just reach out. And what you said was so important, Cecilia, not to say it's going to be okay, to say, I hear you. Things are really tough right now.
Right.
What other advice would you give to people who are reaching out to friends? I mean, I think a lot of people were very honest after these suicides happened and said, hey, can you call me? I'm not feeling so well right now. This happened with a couple of my friends.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. I think a lot of what we do on the crisis line, too, is just listen. I don't think many people are expecting, you know, life-changing advice or an inspirational speech that, you know, somehow changes everything. But if you can create a space, a non-judgmental space, where they can just talk and feel comfortable vocalizing their thoughts and their feelings with you without feeling judged or feeling, you know, like they're making you uncomfortable, that is super important. Because a lot of times people kind of try to put a Band-Aid over the person's feelings and say, like, it's going to be okay, things are going to get better, like, look at this, this makes you happy, you know, because people are so uncomfortable with talking about difficult emotions. Mm. But creating a space where it's okay to talk about those things and those feelings can be really therapeutic.
I think that's excellent advice. And when someone does talk about, even in passing, even in joking about harming themselves, I think it's crucial to take it seriously and not to say, oh, it'll be okay, mm-hmm, to not dismiss it, but just to be there. And there's been a lot written about this, but one of the main things that's been said is showing up in that person's life. And taking them to get help or sitting with them to listen to them, to not judge, and to meet them where they're at and let them feel accepted where they're at.
Right. And I just want to emphasize that it's always okay to ask the person directly, are you feeling suicidal or are you having thoughts of suicide? You never plant the idea in someone's head by asking. That's kind of a myth. So if you have a friend that says, you know, oh, I don't want to wake up tomorrow, or life is just so hard, I feel hopeless, like there's no hope, it's totally appropriate to ask, hey, you know, you said this, are you feeling suicidal? By asking that question, it kind of opens up an open conversation.
I think it's important to remind our friends and loved ones that people, as bad as they feel now, will feel better. People recover from depression. They recover from mental illness. It's a recoverable thing. And yet, sadly, when people make that tragic final decision that terminates their life, it's from a state of believing there's no hope. There is no future. And anything you can do to let your loved one know there is a future and a better future, and that there's healing in the future. And people, it's a preventable, mental illness is preventable and treatable. And I think that optimism needs to convey in your tone of voice and your language when you talk to someone who is really dark, who is really depressed.
David Elliott Lewis is with the Mental Health Association of San Francisco, and Cecilia Villalobos is with San Francisco Suicide Prevention. Let's take a few calls before break. Let's go to Evan in San Francisco. Hi, Evan. Welcome to the show.
Hello?
Hi. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Okay. It's Evan, actually.
Oh, sorry. Hi, Evan.
Yeah, hi. So I just wanted to respond a little to my experience with the San Francisco free clinics. My experience is that they were great about 20 years ago. Now they're seriously underfunded. And they all have long waiting lists, and if you're lucky enough to get in, you get a counselor only every other week, and you have no choice over the counselor. So if you don't connect with that counselor, that's too bad. And the level of the counselors is mixed, plus they're completely overwhelmed with the number of people they have to deal with. And I've been trying to find a private therapist. I have Medicare, which reimburses really well, and Medi-Cal. And almost everybody I've called has been booked, or they're not taking any more insurance clients.
I'm so sorry to hear that. I know you're in San Francisco, so I'd like to mention the Warm Line, which won't give you the same caller every time you call, but we'll give you someone who has their own lived experience. And it's a number you can call right in San Francisco. You can Google the Warm Line for the exact number. But it's free. There's no time limit on the call. And you might find some healing and wellness from that conversation.
And I just found that phone number, 415-421-1880, 415-421-1880.
Thank you.
Cecilia, what would you add?
Yeah, I think, unfortunately, a lot of people have that experience, even though free resources and free services are great and they help a lot of people. They are very underfunded and they do have long waiting lists. And that's really unfortunate that the quality of these free services is compromised because of the funding.
We know that the Trump White House proposed a number of massive budget cuts that will affect people with mental health conditions. What explains funding cuts for these very important crisis centers, especially in wealthy San Francisco? Why is this a problem here?
We are one of the wealthiest cities in the country and the history of the world, and yet we allow so many people to languish unhoused on our streets, to languish unhoused with mental illness, to live in alone in SRO hotel rooms, as seniors, disabled, in dark, dank rooms without help, without connection to the greater world. And Cecilia is right. We have cut services. The caller is right. We have. It's not like it was 20 years ago. I myself am someone with lived experience with mental health challenges, and I sought help 20 years ago, and I got help pretty quickly. Today, it's not like that. Today, there are waiting lists. A caller is right, and it's tragic. Our city's behavioral health budget was cut during the Great Recession of 2008. And while it hasn't been cut further, it's never been restored after 2008. And while the city's economy is booming, they haven't allocated more resources to our we call it behavioral health in the city. We don't use the term mental health. The reason is behavioral health covers both addiction treatment and mental health treatment. And we don't quite even have addiction treatment on demand either. So if you're wanting to seek recovery from a serious drug addiction, you better be prepared to wait it out. And sadly, that people who are seeking recovery don't wait around too long before they relapse again.
So we need to really put pressure on the Board of Supervisors and when we get a new mayor.
And the mayor. And the new
put
mayor.
Put the pressure on the new mayor. If this is the case in San Francisco, what is it like in communities that don't have this kind of wealth?
It's worse, sadly. It's actually worse. We're actually ahead of the curve in terms of treatment and services in our city compared to many other cities.
Mm. Well, thank you for calling in, Evan. Today, we are talking about suicide prevention with David Elliott Lewis. He's with the Mental Health Association of San Francisco. Cecilia Villalobos is with San Francisco Suicide Prevention. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we'll speak with Darnell Moore about his new memoir, No Ashes in the Fire, Coming of Age, Black and Free in America. When he was just 14, three boys from his neighborhood harassed him because they thought he was gay. They tried to set him on fire. Luckily, he escaped. Now he's a writer and a Black Lives Matter activist. I hope you can join us for that tomorrow. Today, we are talking about suicide prevention. We are having a much-needed conversation after the deaths of Kate Spade and Anthony Bourdain. According to the Centers for Disease Control, over the last two decades, suicide rates across the United States have increased 30%. Today, we're joined by Cecilia Villalobos, Development Coordinator with San Francisco Suicide Prevention. David Elliott Lewis is a mental health advocate and Vice President of the Board of Directors of the Mental Health Association of San Francisco. Let's go next to Lee in Mendocino. Hi, Lee. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you, Rose, and thank you so much for this really valuable and relevant program. I'm calling because with numbers like a 30% increase in less than two decades, there is a social causal relationship here that we have to start looking at. And what the gentleman on the panel, I don't know his, remember his name, but he just mentioned how in the wealthiest place on earth, we have people who are living on the street and defecating and eating and bathing on the street, in public, with no privacy, no dignity. This sort of schism that we experience, whether we experience it as the victim or as the onlooker, creates a tremendous amount of inner conflict. And I think we have to look at these causal factors more carefully. And I'm not suggesting that we ignore the individual. Of course, you know, a wide-angle lens is not useful when you're confronted with somebody who's suffering from suicidal ideation, but if we really have social links because it's the fault or the responsibility.
Sorry, Lee, we're losing your line there, but I think I got the gist of your question and comment. Do you want to take that one, David, first?
Lee, this is David. I agree. It's a shameful situation, and we can't lose sight of the broader effects of what it means to see people uncared for. And not all the people in pain and uncared for are sleeping on the street. Again, some of them are hidden away in small single-room occupancy hotel rooms. They're isolated seniors. San Francisco has a shrinking minority base. They are minorities, largely minorities. They're the poor. There's a number of people in pain who don't know how to connect to help or not connected to help, and it's really heartbreaking.
Yeah, and you know, I think the conversation about suicide is becoming broader, and I think people are realizing that there are a lot of social, political, cultural issues that are contributing to a person's suicidal ideation. It's not just a mental health concern. It's not mental illness. Like you mentioned earlier, many, if not most, of the people who got accounted for in the CDC study didn't have a history of mental illness mm-hmm. or a mental health diagnosis. There are definitely societal, political, cultural factors contributing to this epidemic.
Let's talk about guns and the role that guns play here, because firearms accounted for 51% of all suicides in 2016, 45,000 suicides just that year. And yesterday, Democracy Now! Reported that while suicide rates have risen in all but just one state, researchers have found states with strict gun laws have some of the lowest suicide rates, including New Jersey, New York, Massachusetts, Maryland, and Connecticut. And I've read a lot of editorials about this. The sad reality here is that most people who commit suicide with a gun end up dying.
Yes, it's mostly men who do it, and it's mostly white men who do it, and often younger white men who use firearms. And sometimes, tragically, there's also murderous suicide instances where it's self-harm and other harm together. Mm-hmm. And that is preventable. The mythology that leads to so many guns in home is the false belief that guns are needed for self-protection, for home protection. But truly, when there's a gun in the home, it presents a safety threat to every occupant of that home. And an individual is far more likely to die by suicide than homicide. There are far more police officers that are killed by suicide than homicide. And it's the homicide rate is about half the suicide rate in this country, approximately. Yeah. So it's suicide is a huge public health threat. I believe it should be a public health emergency. And anything we can do to limit easy access to firearms and to install red flag laws, where red flag laws are laws that allow for the temporary removal of firearms when there's an immediate sense of threat. Somebody has made calls of threat, or someone has threatened to harm themselves or others. It allows the authorities to temporarily remove firearms from a home. And states that have those red flag laws have lower suicide by gun deaths.
According to the Brady Center to Prevent Gun Violence, every day in the United States, 93 people die from gun violence, 93, and 58 of those deaths are suicides with guns. Cecilia, how do you deal with guns and gun suicide at the San Francisco Suicide Prevention?
So we have, you know, the same kind of procedure and protocol if someone says they want to die by, you know, shooting themselves. But I do feel that it's a huge concern, like David shared, because I think at San Francisco Suicide Prevention specifically, we try to focus on removing the means from the person. So if a person says, I have a gun, we want to get them as far away from the gun as possible. Same with pills or a razor or whatever. So removal of means, or like putting a barrier between the person and their intended means, is super important. That's why there's going to be a safety net put up under the Golden Gate Bridge soon. It got approved last year. So, you know, putting a barrier between a suicidal person and a gun, if they want to use the gun, is super important. It could save lives, mm-hmm. and it should definitely be a topic of discussion in, you know, the gun control debate.
If you're going to, if you have the unfortunate situation of talking to a friend or a loved one or anyone who's talking about harming themselves, I think it's important to ask if they have the means to harm themselves, and then and this is what will happen if they call suicide prevention too. You'll be asked if you have the means, and do you have a plan? Do you have a way to carry out that plan? And that will help inform the later discussion about how to separate that person from the threat.
We should again say that the hotline for National Suicide Prevention, it's 24 hours. It's 800-273-8255, 800-273-8255. There's also a chat available. And David, you mentioned the warm line earlier. A listener just called in to say the warm line run by the San Francisco Mental Health Association has lost its funding and is converting to an all-volunteer staff.
That is true. And that's something we've been working on to try to restore. So what we've had to do is restrict it to callers from San Francisco only. Previously, we took callers from all over the country, then the state of California, and now just San Francisco. So we'll still take calls from San Francisco, but it'll be from volunteers, still people with lived experience, but volunteers.
And again, that number is 415-421-1880. And our listener also says the city clinics mentioned by the caller are abysmal for the lack of staffing and training. There needs to be a lot of pressure put on the board and the new mayor.
Agreed. Yeah,
for
definitely.
Funding for these services. Thank you for that email. Let's go to Patty in San Francisco. Hi, Patty. Welcome to the show.
Yes. I had a question. Why is it when somebody has a debilitating or life-threatening physical illness, they're allowed to euthanize themselves, but for someone who has a lifelong mental health issue that is debilitating, they are not allowed? I know in Belgium they started last year allowing people with that to commit suicide.
I'll let Cecilia answer that.
Well, that is an incredibly complex issue and kind of question to think about. But I think we get it a lot at San Francisco Suicide Prevention, you know, someone's right to die. You know, and our policy, our protocol is to intervene if anyone is planning on attempting suicide, whether they have a debilitating physical illness or not. That's our kind of organization policy. I don't think I'm qualified to say, like, yes, this is wrong, or no, this is not wrong. But I do think a lot of people experience intense physical pain. A lot of people experience intense emotional pain. And it comes down to how us as a society and as a government are helping people cope with that.
Right.
I think there's two different categories of situations. Somebody with a terminal illness mm-hmm. with no hope of recovery and who's in immense pain is in a very different situation with someone who is not who has the prospect of getting better, of recovering, mm-hmm. of having a better future, but still decides, because it's so bleak at the moment, and they see no way out at the current moment, they see suicide as their best option for them.
Right.
Those are two very different situations.
Very different situations. And this is a very heated debate, which we've had for many years in California. In fact, a Superior Court judge just last month overturned a 2016 state law that allows doctors to prescribe lethal drugs to terminally ill adult patients. We should have another conversation about that, because that's a separate issue.
Right.
But thank you for calling in. I want to ask you about young people. I'm just reading now from a recent NPR piece. The number of kids who struggle with thoughts of suicide or who attempt to kill themselves is rising. New research from Pediatrics finds children ages 5 to 17 visited children's hospitals for suicidal thoughts or attempts about twice as often in 2015 as 2008. The study found kids of all ages are affected, though increases were greatest for older adults.
I would actually like to address that. I think that's a critical area. It's, young people are even at more risk of suicide than their older peers. And there are some innovative things being done around the country. NAMI, National Alliance of Mental Illness, mm-hmm. has a program called Ending the Silence. And when we say silence, we mean the silence about talking about self-harm, depression, and suicide. So they actually send speakers, young people with their own lived experience, out into the schools to talk to students about suicide, about depression, about mental illness, and about recovery, and people tell their own stories of recovery. And that lets the kids know that there's a way to get better. It encourages them to seek help from their own school wellness centers, which often they will avoid out of stigma or fear or being labeled negatively. And so I think this Ending the Silence program by NAMI has been really helpful to get that dialogue going.
According to the National Center for Health Statistics, suicide was the 10th leading cause of death in the U.S. in 2015, the second leading cause of death for people aged 15 to 24, and the third leading cause of death for children aged 10 to 14. In this NPR piece, Dr. Robert Dicker, Associate Director of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry at Zucker Hillside Hospital in New York, said it really speaks to the stress and the strain at school. Kids appear to be under much more academic success to achieve and their perception of falling short. Cecilia, what are your thoughts about these numbers?
I definitely think that schools are becoming a lot more competitive and there's a lot more pressure to do well academically. Actually, a researcher at UC Berkeley, Stephen Hinshaw, researched the growing suicide rates in youth, and especially for, teenage girls. But youth are under a lot of pressure to do well academically, but also have all these extracurriculars like sports and clubs and maybe work part-time if their family, if they don't have a lot of resources. So they have to be all around this, perfect person, so mm-hmm. they think. And it really takes a toll on people's mental health. Also, bullying is a huge issue, too.
Bullying, cyberbullying, social mm-hmm. media. This doctor added sexting to the list. Mm-hmm. He said these are the things that we didn't have these pressures before technology.
Right.
The Washington Post also had a piece about suicide rates for black children are twice that of white children. African-American children are taking their lives at roughly twice the rate of their white counterparts. This is according to a new study in the journal JAMA Pediatrics. It confirms a pattern first identified several years ago when researchers in Ohio found that the rates of suicides for black children ages 5 to 12 exceed that of young whites. Cecilia, what can you tell us about race and suicide?
Yeah, so I feel like the discussion around suicide and suicide prevention typically leans over toward the white, middle-aged, cisgender demographic. And while they make up a huge chunk of the people who actually die by suicide, but there's also this rising trend in black youth, black children, Latinx youth and Latinx children, as well as Native American indigenous youth mm-hmm. that goes kind of like underreported and unaccounted for and not really acknowledged. But it is becoming a huge issue. Like there are studies coming out about Latina teenage suicide attempts. And I think different demographics in the United States face different social issues. And it does come back to there being social, political, cultural factors that affect a person's suicidal ideation. And in a country where, kind of racial tension and discrimination and bias is coming up to the surface, I think it's understandable for certain demographics to feel more stress.
Right. According to LakotaLaw.org, rates of suicide among Native Americans are the highest compared to other groups, and they keep increasing.
Right.
This is especially true among Native American youth, who are 3.5 times more likely to commit suicide compared to other groups, according to an Indian Health Service study in 2010. This is a long crisis. I mean, I'm just finding stories from the 90s and the 2000s about how this is a crisis. What is being done about this?
I think what's been done are mostly piecemeal efforts. I think that the suicide crisis lines are helpful, but it's only a small part of the solution. Most cities do have behavioral health clinics. That's helpful, but small part. The Affordable Care Act does require mental health treatment, as I mentioned previously. We might lose that soon. That's helpful. But we need to change, I think, the national dialogue about seeking treatment, about getting help. and we need to help remove the stigma about seeking treatment and getting help and make it as easy as possible for somebody in pain to speak to a mental health professional.
We have an email from Joe who says, I'm interested in having this conversation from a more philosophical perspective, one that examines our cultural notion of self, which I consider to be delusional. The constant pressure to create and perform is destructive on many levels. While it sometimes results in suicide, it spreads discontent, disconnection, and anxiety throughout the population. Our culture has a mental health issue. We shouldn't be foisting the label off on individuals. I think this is such an important point because just walking around in this society is very difficult for a lot of people, especially right now. After this election, in a place like San Francisco, I mean, you're hit with these massive, you know, multi-million dollar penthouses, and then you see so many people living on the streets. So can you talk about our culture and how that contributes to this also?
We do have, sadly, San Francisco has an overheated real estate market, which has brought in a lot of overseas investment, which has driven up pricing, which has caused displacement, which has increased homelessness, which has disproportionately impacted the poor and lower middle class, and even the working class, and even the middle class, which can't even afford housing in San Francisco. So I think the property speculation bubble that's happening in San Francisco that results in all these high-rise cranes you see all over the city, all this luxury, the construction, the new tall Salesforce tower that just went up. I think that's all part of the situation that's creating the pain we see on the streets. It's a complex problem, but yes.
Yeah, and I think from, you know, a sociological point of view, there's a lot of pain in our society, and that's just the reality, even within San Francisco, with all the poverty and the kind of lack of connectedness people feel. I mean, it is a social issue, and it would be foolish to think that this can be a matter of, like, a solution where someone seeks treatment, has a good therapist, a psychiatrist, and everything's fine. I mean, it does have to be a collective social effort, and the people in power, the people who have the power to make changes, need to show that they care and that they empathize and that, you know, they're invested in helping heal this pain.
Mm. We can add so many things to this: massive inequality, people living on a fixed income who barely are getting by. And it's not just here, it's really across the country.
It's true. But I recently attended the National Healthcare for the Homeless Conference in Minneapolis, and it was very eye-opening because it made me realize that the issues that San Francisco faces are not unique. The boom in construction, the displacement, the rise of street homelessness, the street encampments are happening in every city in the country. And the poor treatment of homeless and the inadequate services provided to them and the mental health services falling short. It's not just a San Francisco issue, it's national.
Mm-hmm. We have time for one more caller. Let's go to Wayne in Oakland. Hi, Wayne. Welcome to the show.
Hi. I had a question on whether the hotline operators had within the protocols questions about whether the person calling has been using antidepressants or psychotropic drugs, because frequently the side effects for those include suicidal thoughts and behaviors. And even if they're not using antidepressants, there are many medications, even on television advertised, where their side effects include suicidal thoughts and behaviors. So I was wondering, how do you handle it when a person is calling and saying, well, I'm feeling this, and they have chemicals coursing through their body and to, you know, kind of correlate with that feeling. But I was wondering if there are anything that you can do to anything that's done to discuss that with them.
Yeah, so we don't really have a script or a list of questions that we ask people. The only questions we ask are you feeling suicidal? If so, you know, do you have a plan, and when were you planning on attempting? Those are the only questions that we have to ask. But because our job is to just meet the caller where they're at and kind of let them disclose what their situation is. But I guess if a counselor feels that it's appropriate, they will ask, you know, are you seeing a therapist? Do you have a psychiatrist? Are you taking medication? Yeah, And I feel like most counselors do ask at some point if they feel that the person is struggling with mental illness.
Anything to add, David?
I think Cecilia said it very well.
We have about 2 minutes left. Where do you both want this conversation to go from here?
I'd like to see, for one, more conversations on this very topic. That whole idea of ending the silence I mentioned shouldn't just be a conversation for high school students. It should be occurring at every level of society. Ending the silence, ending the unwillingness to talk about suicide, to talk about mental illness, to talk about the need for help. I think the more we talk about it, the more we have a chance to see the shortfalls in the system, the long waiting list that caller had mentioned that she experienced currently in San Francisco. It's true. I've heard that from many others. And I think if we talk about it more, maybe our new mayor and board of supervisors will step up and make it easier to access services.
Mm-hmm. Cecilia?
Yeah. I would definitely like the people in power, not only in San Francisco, but across the nation, to invest in the quality of behavioral health care services, because I think if we have more services more widely, more widely available that are culturally, relevant and sensitive to different demographics, it's super important, then more people will feel comfortable reaching out for help. And it'll show that us as a society, we care about each other and we want to make this better.
And so this is something listeners can do, is demand more resources from local, state, and national politicians.
Right on. Yes, they can. Yes, that would be a huge help.
David Elliott Lewis is a mental health advocate and vice president of the board of directors of the Mental Health Association of San Francisco. Cecilia Villalobos is development coordinator with San Francisco Suicide Prevention. She's been a volunteer with its suicide hotline for 2 years. And the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline is 800-273-8255, 800-273-8255. Online chat is also available. David, thank you for coming in. Thank you for your work.
Thank you so much for having us.
And Cecilia, thank you for your work and thank you for coming in.
Thank you. Thank you for your invitation.
Coming up tomorrow, we will speak with Darnell Moore about his new memoir, No Ashes in the Fire, Coming of Age, Black and Free in America. When he was just 14, three boys from his neighborhood harassed him because they thought he was gay. They tried to set him on fire. Luckily, he escaped. Now he is a writer and a Black Lives Matter activist. We hope you can join us for that conversation tomorrow. Your Call is produced here at KALW in San Francisco. If you'd like to listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. You can also find us on iTunes, where you can leave us a review. You can find us on Twitter to find out what's coming up at Your Call Radio, and email show ideas and feedback to yourcall@kalw.org. Thanks to Laura Wenis for producing today's show, and thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.